Oakland 2-0. They face the Houston Astros tonight. Our weather forecast calls for variable cloudiness today. Chance of rain later in the day. High close to 80 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Gregory Berg. The morning show with yours truly is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On two previous occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with Galen White, who was for many years a sports writer for the Denver Post, the Arizona Republic, and the Oklahoma Journal. And he has written a number of different books, several fascinating books about baseball. I had the pleasure of speaking with Mr. White about his book Singles and Smiles, How Artie Wilson Broke Baseball's Color Barrier, and also talked with him about his very interesting book, co-authored by former big leaguer Ransom Jackson, a memoir or autobiography of sorts called Handsome Ransom Jackson, Accidental Big Leaguer. Mr. White's latest book is called Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Legends, Near Greats, and Unknowns in the Minors. This is a really fascinating and thorough examination of minor league baseball in America, particularly during its heyday when minor league baseball was far more widespread than most of us would ever imagine. And in particular, this is a book that examines the experiences of some of the finest and most intriguing athletes that played in minor league baseball, but who never made it to the major leagues, or if they did so, enjoyed little or no success there for whatever reason. And it's, in some cases, a great puzzlement how somebody can be so spectacularly successful at the one level of baseball and not quite manage to put it together to get to the next level. But it's still a fascinating story. And in some ways, the fact that we're talking about people who fell short of the ultimate goal make some of these stories especially compelling. The book is published by Roman and Littlefield. Again, it's titled Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Legends, Near Greats, and Unknowns in the Minors. And Galen H. White, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good to be back.
I wonder if you could tell me, first of all, in your work as a sports writer, how much of your time and energy was spent covering minor league baseball, and what was that like?
I didn't cover any minor league baseball, but I grew up watching it. I grew up in Los Angeles when it was a minor league town. The Dodgers came out in 1958. I was 12 years old, and far as I was concerned, the Dodgers could have gone back to Brooklyn. And the reason for that is I enjoyed going to Wrigley Field there in Los Angeles with my father and my brother and watching the Angels play there at a ballpark that was just like the one in Chicago. And I saw some great minor leaguers come through there. They not only played for the Angels, Steve Bilko, who was the subject of my first book, the Bilko Athletic Club, was one of the great stars. I thought he was Babe Ruth when he arrived there in 1955. And other players came through there, several of whom are featured in the book Left on Base.
One of the things that was truly shocking to me was, I think, in the first chapter of the book, when you, in a sense, talk about the dimensions of minor league baseball at its heyday. You tell us that there were 52 minor leagues in 1948, not teams, not minor league teams, minor leagues,
right,
in 1948. Explain how such a thing is even possible.
Well, you had this flood of players coming into the baseball world after World War II. Obviously, during World War II, there was a shortage of players. The minor leagues shrunk tremendously, and then they exploded after the war with the return of the players. Football and basketball were, at least at the professional level, were not that big at that time. Baseball was the sport. It was the national pastime. But as I've learned in doing this book and going out and promoting the book, the national pastime tagline applies to the minors, not the majors. The majors, up until 1953, when the Boston Braves moved to Milwaukee, the majors consisted of 11 of the 16 teams in the majors were in five cities. So the minor leagues were really where the sport was national. In 1949, the heyday, the high point for the minors, there were 59 leagues, 447 towns with teams. And this doesn't count the towns that had semi-pro teams. I'm in Elk City, Oklahoma, as we speak, and they had a great semi-pro team here for 3 years and competed at the highest level in terms of the national level. They finished second 1 year when Joe Bauman played for them, and Joe Bauman went on to return to organized baseball and set the all-time record for home runs in the minors, 72 home runs at Roswell in 1954. So baseball was king. It was truly the reason baseball was a national pastime, and it was the small towns that did it. Hmm.
Explain a little bit how minor league baseball in this era was organized, and in particular, the relationship between minor league baseball and major league baseball. I think most of us, in terms of what we know about the minor leagues, are those teams that had a very direct connection with major league teams and would be, in a sense, sort of a feeder organization. When we're talking about minor league baseball, where there's 52 minor leagues, I suspect that we might be talking about something else that goes beyond that direct relationship with major league.
At that time, many of the teams were independent. They were owned by either the several people of the community or someone who had organized teams in different communities and sort of sold one and then move on to the next. And that was really the case that, say, in Artesia, New Mexico, the owner there had owned several teams prior to that, and he wanted to recruit Joe Bauman, so he came to Elk City, Oklahoma, where Joe had just finished playing 3 years of semi-pro ball, and he realized his career probably was over because the Elk City team couldn't afford to keep going. And he was pumping gas at his Texaco station when the owner drove in and asked him, he was on his way to the annual baseball meetings in Columbus, Ohio, and he drove into his station and asked him, if I buy your contract, will you come back to organized baseball? And he did. And, of course, he went on from Artesia to set the record in Roswell. But independent ball clubs were quite common at that time. There were teams, of course, with tie-ups with the majors. In L.A., where I grew up, the Angels were connected with the Chicago Cubs, so many of the players I saw play with the Angels went on and played for the Cubs. In fact, I didn't see Ransom Jackson play in L.A. in 1949, but Ransom Jackson, who I co-authored a book with, Accidental Big Leaguer, he played for the Angels before going up and playing for the Cubs.
I see in your book references to letters, A, B, and C, and D. Can you explain what those designations are?
Yes. At that time, the minor leagues went all the way down to what they called Class D. That was the lowest level, but it wasn't exactly the lowest level in terms of quality. The classifications were based on population of the city. So the smallest cities were in Class D. The next level was Class C. Then there was B, A, AA, AAA, and then there was one open classification league, and that was the Coast League. Now, those classifications changed slightly. For example, the Coast League at one time was a AA league, and then it moved up to AAA and then open classification. My book, Left on Base, quite a bit of it pertains to players at the Class D and C level. Joe Bauman, who I've been talking about, played at Class C. He never got, except for one at-bat in Class AA with Minneapolis, he never got higher than Class A, and that was at Hartford, Connecticut, in the Eastern League. He didn't like playing back east. He wanted to go back out west, and so he and also he was in a contract dispute with the Boston Braves, who owned his contract. And they wanted to cut his salary $200, and he said, I can make more money selling shoestrings in the street in Oklahoma City. So he left organized baseball and was going to play semi-pro ball, and that's, of course, what he did here in Elk City, and then eventually he returned to organized ball. In the case of many of the players, they could make more money at in the minors. Joe Bauman, for example, did quite well at the lowest level of the minors, and then also he picked up extra money in a tradition they called picking the screen. When a player hit a home run, the hometown fans, particularly in West Texas and eastern New Mexico and in Oklahoma, they would stick money through the screen for the guy who hit the home run. In Joe's case, he made a lot of money that way. In fact, when he broke the record in 1954 on the last day of the season, he hit three home runs. He collected that day $800, which would be the equivalent today of $8,000.
Fascinating. We're speaking with Galen H. White about his book, Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Legends, Near Greats, and Unknowns in the Minors. As I'm talking with you, I'm reminded of a couple of morning show conversations that I've had about the Negro Leagues. And one of the issues, at least in some aspects of that, is that in some cases, information is now lost. How carefully kept are the records of minor league baseball, especially at this point in time when there were so many minor leagues and so many teams all across the country? Is some of this legacy in terms of statistics lost to us now, or by and large are the statistics rather meticulously kept?
They were meticulously kept. There were statisticians, several key ones throughout the country, who kept all the numbers for the different leagues. For example, on the West Coast, there was a gentleman named William Weiss, and he kept stats for something like a couple dozen leagues. And there were several like him across the country. They were also published annually in the baseball guide that Sporting News put out. In fact, my fascination with the baseball guides is one of the reasons I wrote this book. I remember going through my baseball guides every year. It would come out in the spring, and you'd go through, and they'd have photographs of the players who led the league in hitting from Class A on up through the minors. And I remember going through year after year and seeing this picture of one fellow named Al Pinkston. He was a black player and became known as the greatest minor league hitter you never heard of. He won six minor league batting titles, four of them in the Mexican League, one in the Sally League, and one in the Class C Provincial League. And for five of those six batting titles, his picture was in the Sporting News. So every time I would see it, I'd say, why is this guy going higher? He keeps winning batting titles. What is it? And so I interviewed Al Pinkston. It turns out Al shaved 9 years off his age. And so he wound up playing up until age 48. And four of those batting titles he won after age 40.
Wow. That's amazing in and of itself, isn't it?
It is, and that's the reason he's in the Mexican League Baseball Hall of Fame. A great hitter. And, in fact, many people referred to him as sort of the Babe Ruth of the lower minors. But and when I say lower minors, the Mexican League were classified as high as double A. It varied at times. But he was a great hitter, and nobody heard of him.
You've touched on something that I was going to ask you about a little later in the interview, but let's talk about it now. And that is the matter of race relations within minor league baseball. And I want to ask you more specifically about one particular manager, James J. Haney, who was interested in perhaps bringing in some African Americans into his club. But first I want to ask you more generally about the fact that there were Mexicans and Cubans, and eventually black players in minor league baseball. Depending on where you were in the country, how big an issue was this, both for minor league baseball itself and for the fans?
It, of course, was the biggest issue was in the South. Let's say, for example, Savannah, where Al Pinkston won the batting title in 1954, the year after Henry Aaron won the batting title in the same league. And he faced a lot of racism. He dealt with it pretty good, as well as anybody could. Of course, he won the batting title. He won the fans over that way. In Texas, it was a little different. You had Jay Haney, you mentioned, in a Class C league, the West Texas New Mexico League. He'd been in the military. He'd played with black players. And he was asking himself the question, look, they're good enough to fight our wars. They were great to play with baseball with in the minors. Why can't we have them on our teams? And in particular, at the time Jay was asking this question, there was an attrition of baseball players in the lower minors because of the Korean War. So a lot of talent was being lost to the war effort. And so Jay was needing ball players, and he didn't want to pay some of the salaries that the more experienced players were demanding. So he raised that question and recruited the first black player in the state of Texas. Now, the player didn't stay in La Mesa long. People in La Mesa stayed away, obviously, because it was their protest of the black player. But on the road, the La Mesa team drew pretty good-sized crowds because they came out to see the lone black player. Elsewhere in Texas, there was a manager named Pat Stacy. He probably could have played in the majors, but the war came along, and when it was over, he decided to stay in Texas, play minor league baseball. In fact, he owned a team in Big Spring, Texas. And he filled that team, except for himself, with Cubans. Now, they were light-skinned Cubans, and, of course, they faced some of the same racism that the black players faced, up to a point. But they won two titles in the Longhorn League, finished second three times, third another time. And other teams started to emulate what Big Spring was doing. That eventually tore down the walls of segregation in Texas.
One of the things I found interesting about the story of James J. Haney and his efforts to, in a sense, integrate minor league baseball in this respect was that when he decided he was going to do this, you tell us he scheduled a one-day all-Negro tryout camp, believed to be the first for professional players in the United States, and invited blacks from throughout the country. And you tell us that 20 hopefuls ultimately showed up. But it's just so intriguing to think about organizing an event specifically for and only for black players to come and try out. I mean, in a sense, there's something just a little bit heavy-handed about that. And on the other hand, this is what he wanted to accomplish, and he believed it was the best way to do it.
And he signed two players who attended that camp. And the camp, there was a huge turnout of people in La Mesa to see the black players work out. So there were probably as many fans attending the workout session that had attended a game. La Mesa was a dandy little baseball town. The population was only about 8,000 or 9,000, and they drew over 100,000 people one season, 1951, I believe it was, and they named themselves the biggest little town in baseball. So you had quite a few small towns that prided themselves in baseball, and they broke new ground. Now, obviously, Jay Haney faced resistance, but I think what he accomplished there really was the beginning of the integration of baseball in Texas.
And I so appreciate the fact that you tell us this story of La Mesa, Texas, and the fact that at its height, it was drawing more people to its games than places like Amarillo and Albuquerque. I mean, it's just extraordinary to think about a tiny little town having baseball be so popular. But you tell us by the end of this chapter called Following a Dream that when you go there now, there is absolutely no trace of the ballpark that once stood there in La Mesa, Texas.
That's true. I was just there in La Mesa for a book signing, and while there's no ballpark there, there still is the love and passion for baseball, and certainly the remembrance of the team they had. They have a little museum there, and they've got a one section of it devoted to their La Mesa baseball tradition. So it's still there, and it kind of has led me to conclude this, that pro baseball, the small towns didn't leave pro baseball. Pro baseball left the small towns.
Hmm. And, of course, one of the abiding themes of your book is that there was such a strong connection between the players and the towns where they played. You write at one point, this is what made the minor leagues of the 1950s so special. The players belonged to the towns where they played, and their accomplishments and fame were the source of great civic pride long after they left.
Absolutely. And I can relate to that growing up again in L.A. The players who I would see as a kid, I would follow them throughout their careers. If they went up to the Cubs, I followed them there. If they were traded to somewhere else, I followed them. In fact, when Ransom Jackson came along and wanted me to help him on his book, I'd been following Ransom his entire career because he came through L.A. Now, I didn't see him play there, but I knew he'd played for the Angels. Frosty Kennedy, who hit 228 home runs in 10 years in the minors, and he hit 60 at Plainview, Texas in 1956. He never made it above Class A. He made more money in the minors, plus he was treated to dinner and drinks everywhere he played. And he said this, I was a king in the minor leagues. Why go up to the majors and be just a spear carrier?
Hmm. We're speaking with Galen H. White. We're talking about his most recent book, which is called Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Legends, Near Greats, and Unknowns in the Minors. I want to be sure to ask you about such an intriguing moment in the very first chapter of the book, which is called Bushes and Bushers, Three Bush League Legends and Two Unknowns. Ahead of that question, I want you to explain this term Bush Leagues. Where does that come from?
Well, it was, you could find it in Sporting News well before Ring Lardner sprinkled his great stories about baseball in the early 1900s with the terms Bushers and Bush Leagues. He wrote a series of letters, letters from the busher, from a busher, and they were you know me, Al, letters, where he wrote it to a friend back in, I think it was Indiana, Jack Keefe was the guy he was writing to. And he'd write all these stories, and he'd use the term Bush League, Busher, frequently in these. And I was a big fan of Ring Lardner, loved his writing, and I just kind of loved the whole picture he was painting in these little small towns, letters from the busher. There's one book where I think every title has busher or bush league in the chapter title. So that's what intrigued me about it. Initially, I wanted to call the book Left on Base in the Bushes. The publisher wanted to use the term bush leagues. But bushes, to me, is more descriptive because it doesn't demean the leagues, but it kind of tells that this was the kind of the frontier of baseball, and that's where I found it fascinating.
Yes. So at the very beginning of this chapter, again titled "Bushes and Bushers," you tell us that Philip K. Wrigley, of course, longtime owner of the Chicago Cubs, had an interesting idea, you tell us, in the early 1950s, where he wanted the terms major and minor to be eliminated altogether. Explain what Mr. Wrigley had in mind, and I'd also love to hear your speculation on what baseball would have looked like if Philip K. Wrigley had gotten his way.
I've never been asked that question, but he compared it with, let's say, GM, which at that time had cars such as what they still do, Buick and Pontiac and Chevrolets. Each one, they had appealed to a different audience. One did not necessarily demean or put the other one, cast a bad light on the other. So when they promoted the Buick, it didn't in any way dismiss the Pontiac as a fine car. People knew that the Buick and the Pontiac were a higher level than a Chevrolet, but the Chevrolet was still the car that when you thought about seeing the USA, you see it in the Chevrolet. So Philip Wrigley, that's what he was seeking, was a more imaginative marketing approach to baseball rather than this term of major and minor. Minor, immediately, you're belittling the quality of your product. And baseball is the only sport that has done that. Now, there's some other sports that have come along now, and they have a minor league type like basketball, but they don't, you know, you don't think of it that way. It's just they have a different name for it, and people just know it's not the NBA, but they don't call it minor. And, of course, in basketball, they have got the colleges producing a lot of their players, and now in baseball that's happening too. But baseball was the only sport that had this major and minor division, and immediately it kind of cast this negative light on the players in the minors. And there was just some great players in the minors. The cover of the book is a photograph taken from Life magazine in 1948, and there were 515 players, rookies, at Dodgertown looking up at the camera. Just imagine, 515 players at spring training. Obviously, they didn't get a good look. They were in there, they ran around, and pretty soon they were farmed out to, I think at that time the Dodgers had 24 farm clubs. So it was a very competitive time, and so you had a lot of these really outstanding players who were in the minors, and many of them elected to just stay there. Or if they went up, they would want to go back to the minors. And one example of that is Tom Jordan Sr., who currently is 99 years old. He'll turn 100 on September 5. He played for three different major league teams. Each case, he wanted to go back to his farm in Roswell, New Mexico, made more money on his farm than he did in baseball. And in 18 minor league seasons, he hit .338, so he's a pretty good hitter.
Wow. A little later in this chapter, you write these words: "In no other professional sport is success on one level so overshadowed by the lack of success on another. A minor league star that doesn't make it to the big leagues or live up to expectations while there is a flop.
Yep.
Rarely is there an in-between." Explain more about what you're saying there.
Well, I base that, one of my boyhood heroes was Steve Bilkel. I almost said Babe Ruth, but he was Babe Ruth to me. And I later found out that somebody else named Bobby Gritch, who went on to play in the majors, had quite a bit of success. He also viewed Steve Bilkel as Babe Ruth. Bilkel weighed anywhere between 235 pounds and 270. He was 6'1". He had this Ruthian build. I found out later he had the Ruthian consumption capabilities of beer. And he came to L.A. in 1955. He had 38 home runs. Next year he had 55. And next year he had 56. 148 home runs in three seasons. I thought he was Babe Ruth. He did have some success in the majors. In fact, before he got to L.A., he had a rookie season in St. Louis where he hit 21 homers and batted at 84 runs. That wasn't good enough to stay with the Cardinals. He did go back to the majors after L.A. He had a 20 home run season after the Angels, after there was expansion, and the Angels got a team in that expansion. That would have been 1961. But still, as I would read about Steve Bilkel later on, people would refer to him as a flop. And I just thought, not only is that cruel, it's not correct. And I saw so many books come along describing some of these players who I'm writing about, and just being rather dismissive of them as players and what they did in the major leagues. In fact, just the term, a cup of coffee, which is often used to describe a guy who only played a few games in the majors, and that was applied to Artie Wilson. That's very dismissive, a cup of coffee. And I admit I use it too. But these guys were great players, and in many cases they preferred a career or life in the minors because they got to play every day. In many cases, they made more money. I mean, Artie Wilson, who I feature in the book Singles and Smiles, he asked to go back down to the minors, and he told Leo DeRozier, bring Willie Mays up. He knew more about Willie Mays than Leo DeRozier because he had played with Willie Mays at Birmingham in the Negro Leagues in 1948. So that was really what I wanted to bring out in this book. And I think in all of my books, I like to feature obscure players because I think their stories need to be told. and they need to be preserved in our history books on baseball.
Hmm. Do you have time for just a couple more questions?
I sure do.
Let me just reintroduce you again, Galen H. White. We're talking about left on base in the Bush Leagues, legends, near greats, and unknowns in the minors. I'd love to ask you about a couple of the players that you highlight in your book. One of the most intriguing, it's a story that I did not know at all, that of someone named Bob Cruz, nicknamed Round Trip, because of all of the home runs that that he hit. And you tell us in particular about his pursuit of a certain landmark, which could have landed him on a Wheaties box.
Yes,
tell our listeners this story.
Yeah. Well, man, if he'd gotten on that Wheaties box, he wouldn't be so obscure, would he? He had 69 home runs going to the last day of the season. It was a doubleheader. And all he needed was one more home run, and that would have put him on the cover of Wheaties. He had several hits that day, but no home runs. The wind was blowing in there in Amarillo, so the wind that he had benefited from to get to the 69 mark on that particular day was blowing in. He got no home runs, and he wasn't on the Wheaties box. But what he does have is the all-time record for runs batted in, and it's a phenomenal number, 254 RBIs in 138 games.
And it's just really interesting to think about how a story could be so huge in the moment and be lost to us now.
I first heard the story about Bob Cruz when I was attending the University of Oklahoma. I used to hang out at this pawn shop owned by a guy who had had an English degree, a master's degree in English from the University of Arkansas, and he had his pawn shop in Norman, Oklahoma. And I would hang out there because it was a great place for storytelling. And I always remember Earl telling me about being a salesman in Amarillo. And all these games were on the radio, and he was just telling me of the huge interest in Bob Cruz's pursuit of that record. Of course, I didn't know anything about Bob Cruz at that time, but that got my curiosity, and of course, I went on to write about him. But there's other players in the book as well. Bob Dillinger, what fascinated me. Now, Bob had success in the majors, batted 306 over six seasons in the majors. But he played for losing teams all the way through, from the St. Louis Browns to the Philadelphia Athletics to the Pittsburgh Pirates. The only team that was not in the cellar when he played for him was Chicago White Sox. Bob was known by some as a clubhouse lawyer. I don't believe that was really accurate. He didn't necessarily care for management. He didn't care for some of his managers. And he got kind of crossways with him. And eventually he was exiled to the Pacific Coast League. He played for the Sacramento Solons. He called them the Saloons. And Bob won the batting title there his second year, 366. He'd had some fielding problems in the majors at third base. He wore Coke bottle glasses, so it was amazing that he could hit as well as he did. But on the, in the field, he had some problems. And back in the Coast League, he switched to the outfield, became a quite good outfielder, but he never got another chance in the majors. So Bob Dillinger is a little twist on the theme, left on base in the Bush Leagues, but he essentially was exiled there and finished his career in the Coast League.
Hmm. One of the biggest success stories in minor league baseball would be someone you've already mentioned briefly in this interview, Joe Bauman. You call him the most famous baseball player never to set foot on a big league diamond. Tell our listeners about what he achieved in his greatest season in minor league baseball.
Well, he had what Sports Illustrated referred to as stats, numbers out of Paul Bunyan. He had 72 home runs. He batted in
one season.
In one season, that's 1954, and that set the all-time record. Cruz had tied it in 1948, tied a record set earlier by Joe Hauser at Minneapolis in the 30s. So Joe came along in 1954, hit 72 home runs. He batted in 224 runs, had a .400 batting average, and he did all this in 138 games. Joe was 6'5", 245 pounds. He looked like Paul Bunyan. One of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. You know, he would acknowledge, hey, This wasn't done in the big leagues, but he said, I can pee as high on the wall as anybody.
And what is so interesting is that he seemed as happy pumping gas for people at his service station as he was out on the diamond. And as a matter of fact, he let all of this go. That is, let go of the game of baseball fairly soon after he had this amazing season.
Yes, that's true. He of course, he was in his 30s when he set the record. I think he was 32. He played one more full season, 1955. He had 46 home runs. And he started the 56th season. He had some ankle problems. He had slipped during the winter, which aggravated his issue with one of the ankles. And he hit 17 home runs in 52 games that last season. But Joe was quite content to pump gas because he made good money. Baseball was kind of frosting on the cake for him. And so he had in his contract when he signed, when he came, returned to organized baseball to play for Artesia, New Mexico in 1952, he had a contract where he could buy it out anytime he wanted. And what he wanted to do was, as he did in Elk City, have a Texaco station. Artesia was a town of around 8,000 people, and he considered it too small to have a gas station. So when he got a chance to get a gas station in Roswell, New Mexico, that's when he switched from Artesia to Roswell, and it was in that season, 1954, that he set the all-time record of 72 home runs. Extremely nice guy, very generous. He would every time he hit a home run in Roswell, there was a meatpacking plant that gave him a free ham. And he hit so many home runs, he was giving hams to his teammates, hams to the umpires, and he called the Roswell team the best-fed team in America.
I also want to give you a chance to talk about a really interesting twosome, and that would be a father and son, Tom Jordan and Tommy Jordan, not only because their story in and of itself is, I think, very special and interesting, but also because it raises some really interesting questions about the relationship between Little League and the minor leagues. That's raised a little later in the chapter. But tell our listeners who Tom and Tommy Jordan were.
Well, Tom Jordan Sr. played 18 years in the minors, played with three teams in the majors, and as I mentioned earlier, is currently the oldest living major league ball player at age 99. His son Tom Jordan Jr. pitched and hit Roswell to the Little League World Series in 1956, the only time any team from New Mexico has done that. In fact, it's the only time any team from New Mexico has made it to Williamsport among the elite group. I didn't start out to... Tom Jordan was not initially part of this book. I was interviewing him about Joe Bauman and Bob Cruz and some of the other players he played against. And then he made a comment one day about how the biggest thrill in his baseball career was his son winning the Little League World Series. And then I asked the question, were you there? No, I wasn't. I was at the side of the road with my wife listening to the game on the radio. And they were halfway between Carlsbad and Roswell so they could get a better radio reception. And so that's how he listened to the game. And then during our conversations, he made another comment. And that was, he said, you know, Little League Baseball helped kill Minor League Baseball. The demise of minor league baseball can be equated with the rise in popularity of Little League baseball, and that's especially true there in Roswell. But it also applies to other small towns, because as the minor leagues were struggling, the Little League was growing. The parents and the grandparents who previously were going to minor league games now were going to Little League games to see their son or their grandson. So I thought that was an interesting observation, and I bounced it off some others, and then I looked at the stats, and it's true. Little League Baseball helped contribute to the demise of minor league baseball, along with the increased popularity of television and, of course, the advent of air conditioning.
Right. Yeah, there were a couple of things that were at play here. By the way, we should probably make sure that our listeners understand that when you talk about this particular team from Roswell that we are talking about, Roswell, New Mexico, the place that is so famous for being supposedly the landing site, the crash landing site of a UFO. And you tell us quite rightly that the story of Tommy Jordan was a glorious day in 1956 when Roswell was known for something other than UFOs.
That's right. In fact, I include in the Joe Bauman chapter a little bit of a story by Harry Turtledove, who's best known for his books on alternative history. And Harry wrote a little piece on Joe Bauman and aliens visiting his Texaco station there in Roswell, New Mexico. And I remember asking Harry, I said, have you ever been to Roswell? He said, no, I've been to Albuquerque. But he went on to say that when you think of Roswell, you think of two things, Joe Bauman's home run record and the UFOs. And I think you could also add to that this Little League team, which, by the way, they won the Little League World Series title in 1956, the year before the team from Monterrey, Mexico, won the title. And, of course, they made a movie about that team. In my opinion, they should have made a movie about that Roswell team because it was an amazing team. They had another outstanding pitcher named Farrell Dunham. And between Farrell and Tommy Jordan, they were they were unbeatable. And anyway, it's a great story about, I call it father, son, and Little League. And I think it is interesting. Tom Jordan Sr. lives with his son, Tom Jordan Jr. now, and his wife, Sheila. And just wonderful people. Tom went to the doctor the other day, about a month ago, and the doctor looked him over and said, you look great. You're going to live to be 100. He said, well, hell, Doc, that's just 3 months.
We certainly don't have time to touch on all of the players who you highlight in this book, but I want to finish out with the story of Steve Delkowski. Because, well, first of all, in some respects, the central question raised by your book is why some of these marvelous minor league players don't achieve success in the majors. And in many cases, it's a little bit hard for us to know the answer to that. It really isn't hard for us to know the answer when it comes to Steve Delkowski, an extraordinarily gifted pitcher, and yet someone who had some problems that really help explain why he could never take this potential to where it sort of deserved to go. Tell our listeners about Steve Delkowski.
Most people consider Steve Delkowski as being the hardest thrower in the history of baseball. Cal Ripken Sr. Caught Steve Delkowski and said that he threw harder than Nolan Ryan. Most people who saw Delkowski pitch say he threw harder than anyone they'd ever seen. They tried to use a radar gun on him, but that this particular technology, he had to get the ball within a certain space, and he had a hard time doing that. His nickname, one of his nicknames, was Whiff or Walk Delkowski. One season, he walked 262 batters, and he also struck out 262 batters. Cal Ripken was so high on Delkowski that he said that if he ever could control his fastball and he made it to the majors, he would have struck out 21 players a game. That's just how hard he threw. Unfortunately, Steve had an alcoholic father. He developed alcoholism and bad drinking habits very early on. In his second game as a pro, he hit a player in the ear. Myth has it that he tore off the earlobe of that player. That is not the case. The player who I interviewed still has that earlobe, but he does remember it hurting pretty badly. But he became very, some people attribute this incident with affecting Steve long term. He did never pitched in the big leagues. He made it to spring training camp with the Baltimore Orioles 1 year, and he had a great spring training. Everybody thought he was going to make it that year. In fact, Topps printed a baseball card of Steve Delkowski, and then he suffered an injury in one of the spring training games, and that was the end of it. When he retired, when he left baseball, Sporting News referred to him as a legend, and he is a true legend, as is Ron Netschei, who I write about in the same chapter, who struck out 27 in a 9-inning game. And that chapter is called The Tale of Two Legends. And they both kind of the high points of their minor league career was when Nechai struck out 27 in Bristol, Virginia in 1952, and Dalkowski started his career at Kingsport, just a few miles from Bristol, in 1957. So I tie the two in this one chapter, and I use a longtime catcher who never made it to the majors except as a coach, Harry Dunlop. He caught the game that Nechai struck out 27, and then he managed Dalkowski near the end of his career in the minors, and Dalkowski had his greatest success. But Dunlop was a great person to talk with about both because he was there at the end of Dalkowski's career, and his view was the same as everybody else. He would have been a great one if he'd been able to control his drinking.
Right. And you tell us in a very sad postlude to Steve Dalkowski's story that his personal problems, his struggles with alcoholism only escalated after his retirement from baseball, and there were actually long periods of time that he was actually homeless. His is one of the sadder stories. We should probably hasten to add that, for the most part, this is really a joyous book. And even if in some cases we're talking about players who did not ultimately achieve maybe the success they might have dreamt of, had a success all of their own, kind of a special success that we associate with minor league baseball.
Well, in Steve Dalkowski's case, there is, I think, as happy an ending as you could have. He is still living. He turned 80 here in June. He's in a nursing home in New Britain, Connecticut, where he first achieved stardom. And he's still living because of people like Ray Youngdahl, who after his baseball career, and he was a teammate of Steve Dalkowski, he became a social worker. And he rescued Steve from Skid Row in Oildale, California, put him in an alcohol rehab program. And that was the start of Steve eventually finding the help he needed on back in Connecticut. So it's a joyous story in many respects. Ray Youngdahl and I have become great friends, and I sent him a copy of the book, and after he got it, he read it a little bit, and he called me back, and he says, I want to order a case of your books. I want to give these to my friends. I want them. He says, this is helping me remember things that I have forgotten, and I want to give them to some friends who are about the same age as he in their 80s. He says, I think it will help them remember things that they've forgotten. So I think this is that kind of a book that will help people who are maybe older and maybe have forgotten certain things. This will bring back certain memories from their time as younger people and following baseball. And for people who maybe are younger, it will introduce them to an era when baseball was truly the national pastime, and also introduce them to some players that have had a few things have been differently. They would be right up there with the superstars of the game.
Mm. The book, again, is Left on Base in the Busch Leagues, Legends, Near Greats, and Unknowns in the Minors, published by Roman and Littlefield and the author Galen H. White. Galen H. White, you've done it again. Thank you for writing yet another fascinating book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about
it. This interview has been a grand slam. I hope the book is, too.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will be talking with Tim Mahone about the Mahone Foundation. And, of course, that's just ahead of the Harbor Park Jazz event, which is coming up this weekend. We'll find out about the great work that the Mahone Foundation does. On Wednesday, WGTD's own Dave McGrath, along with his wife Guida Brown, will be joining us to talk about a very interesting trip that they took earlier this summer, in which they retraced the final concert tour of Buddy Holly, a concert tour which, of course, ended tragically in a plane crash and Buddy Holly's death. On Thursday, Tom Howard, who is the author of an intriguing book called The Making of a Democratic Economy, he poses some interesting questions on how we should think about our economy differently. And on Friday, more reminiscences from people who attended Woodstock as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. That exact anniversary to the day comes up later this coming week. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It's